recognizes some region where it knows that it has to begin translating, and then from that point onwards it takes triplets and translates each triplet into an appropriate amino acid. So, and if I'm going too slow, it sometimes feel free to tell me, so you know, I don't have to. Okay, so the translation is not correct, but you know, we don't know a whole lot about how this translation starts. We do know that the initiating codon is almost always ATG, and it translates into the residue methionine. All the other translations are bogus because I just made them up. But there is a fixed code. Every triplet corresponds to a fixed amino acid. Okay, and then it keeps translating till it comes to what's the stop codon, and then it stops. And this is the functional protein. Okay. So this talk is mostly about finding signals. We know that there is this cellular machinery that slides along the transcript and recognizes the region where it has to begin translating. Right? That's what we call a DNA signal. So it's to define it formally, it's a stretch, it's a region of the genomic sequence that can be recognized by some cellular apparatus, and that might be protein or might be a composite of protein and RNA and so on. So for example, the ribosomal machinery would recognize the translation initiation site, and then there are spliceosomes which recognize the sites of splicing and so on. Okay. Now, for the purposes of our, for this talk, we assume that these signals are somewhat short. They mostly are. So, you know, they fall within a 15-20 base pair window. And what you'd like to do is, given an unknown string of length, say, you know, appropriate length, 15 base pairs, say, you want to be able to say whether this could be a signal for the particular machinery that we are talking about. So the general question is that you have all of these unknown sequences, and you want to get the distribution of the probability that this could be a signal for the appropriate machinery. Okay. So how do we do that? Well, first you go back and see what there are some specific properties that are signals that we assume our signal has. One is that specific positions are conserved, or they are important in the signal. So if you go back two slides, you look at the ATG. This, there might be some variation here, but this is usually invariant. So the starting the three letters here, ATG, should be there for translation to happen. So that's to say that if this was the signal, then position 4, 5, and 6 would be somewhat conserved and important. And the other positions are somewhat variable. Okay. Of course, to estimate the probabilities, you'd like to have, if you had all of, you know, if you had the complete distribution, complete set of sequences and the knowledge as to how strong a particular signal was, it would be easy to estimate these probabilities, but usually there isn't enough data. So people try various approximations to estimating the probabilities. And the first one that we'll talk about is this method of profiles. It actually stands for translation start site.
Okay.
But
also transcription start site.
Also transcription start site, yeah. So we, for the purpose of our talk, we should just think of this as a signal, because it could be any signal. But yeah, it doesn't have to be translation start site. I mean, the rest of the talk is going to be very general.
Well, there is something in front of this ATP, which is also peptide.
Yes. In fact, the reason for doing this on translation initiation sites is because there's a biologist at Rutgers, Marilyn Kozak, who spent her sort of life determining what this signal is like. And she has published many papers, and among them, there were reports like the position minus one of the ATG is correlated with the position plus four of the ATG. So this and this are correlated. Whether or not that's true is actually a matter of some debate. But that's, you know, these kinds of correlations motivate the rest of the talk, why we want to model these appropriately, so that we can handle these correlations.
If you use the word translation, you're really thinking about messenger RNA and seeds that you use.
Yes. For the purpose of this talk, yeah, we think of them as cDNA or mRNA, but you're right that if it was indeed messenger RNA, we should have it as U. But there's a reason for keeping this as T. typically when you want to apply this problem in computer science, you have genomic sequence given to you, and you want to be able to say, which has, you know, ACGs and Ts, and you want to be able to say, this could be a functional translation start site once transcription happened and this was in the cytoplasm. So you know, most of the algorithms are applied to genomic DNA where we have ACGs and Ts. Okay, so the profile method is simple to state. Because we know that certain positions are sort of invariant, it's easy to align the signal. And so you take a bunch of signals that are very, that are strong signals in practice. And then you look, and then you imagine that each of these columns was generated by an arbitrary but fixed distribution. Okay, so in this case, you know, you can see that C appears 5 out of 6 times. So the probability that you, so if you had a C, if you had an unknown sequence and you wanted to score it, and if it had an A here, you could say that this probably isn't the signal. But if it had a G, you could say that maybe there's a probability 0.2 that this was the first position of a signal. Okay, and so, and you assume that all of these positions are generated independently of each other. So if you had a sequence like this, for example, CGG, an unknown sequence, the probability of this being a signal would just be the probability that this is generated at the first position, which is 0.8 times, you know, 0.8 and so on. And in this case, you get a C, a T out here, so the whole probability becomes 0. Yes? Pardon me? So there are biological protocols that you can use to isolate these sequences. For example, in this particular case, it's rather easy because you have a lot of genes for which you know the structure.
From the real DNA.
From real DNA. Okay. No, the ATG is out here.
You focus on well the ATG.
And then you come up with some sort of consensus link with which it's around the ATG.
Yes, I'm skipping over that. But you assume that you know approximately what the length of the signal is. And you can try out a few things and see that.
And you assume that they're equal a priori probabilities for each one of these. I mean, is the frequency with which they appear?
Yeah, I'm totally skirting over those issues. But in reality, what you would do is you would, let's say you take your genomic DNA and compute some a priori probabilities, and then take the odds ratio, and that would be your score. But all that is, you know, just to simplify things, I'm sort of assuming this. Okay. But look at, let's look at this sequence. Now, notice that there is no difference between these two sequences, except that there's an A in the third position here, and there's a G in the third position here. And if you look at the profile here, both of them have a probability of 0.5, so their probability should be actually equal. But if you look at the data more carefully, and let's say, I mean, this is, you know, this, let's say that you had enough data that this would be convincing, you notice that whenever you have a G here, you always have an A here. So if you look at, look here, whenever you have a G here, you always have an A here. Okay, and whenever you have a G here, you always have a C here. So in reality, this sequence could never, I mean, this is really not a true signal sequence. Okay, the fact is simply that there's dependence between these two positions, which, you know, because you assume independence, you don't capture. So it's a very straightforward thing, but it means that the method might not always work. Okay, and so people tried to remedy it, and most of them were simple remedies. First was to assume some kind of a low Markov dependency. So you assume that every position is dependent on one other position. And what Zhang and Mar in 93 and then independently Salzburg in 97 assumed was that the adjacent positions were where most of the dependencies occurred. So, you know, you could approximate this probability by just taking the first one and the second one dependent on the first and third one dependent on the second and so on. Okay, so biologically, this captures a lot of the dependencies, but in reality, there could be a lot more complex dependencies that this obviously won't capture. And you know, some examples might help us describe how these dependencies can arise. So look at this simple example with three columns. And there could be any number of columns in between, so they don't have to be adjacent. Okay. First, of course, the profile method doesn't work because you can it gives a positive probability to t here, but the sequence TTT actually never arises. So this is, of course, bogus. Then the VAM method also, which takes adjacent columns into account, also will not give a good estimate of TTC, because whenever you have a TT, you always have an A in front of it. Straightforward. But let's look at what the dependency structure of this matrix is. First, note that there's some dependency between all three columns. But the most sort of glaring dependency is of the following. If you knew what this column was, you would know what these columns were, exactly.
So, the previous one.
Yes.
Can you go back 1 minute?
Yeah.
You had probability of S3 given S1 and S2, right?
Yeah, that's, well, if you had enough data to estimate all higher order dependencies, okay, you would never have any problem. But you always need to approximate.
Approximate, that was like next.
Yeah, and that's the method. The method assumes a fixed Markov chain, and then all the dependencies are along the Markov chain. Okay, so the first thing to note is that the dependencies don't have to be symmetric. If you knew that there's an A here, you'll always know that there's a T here. But if you knew that there was a T here, there could be an A here and there could be a C here. Okay, so the dependency is not symmetric. And likewise, if you knew this, you'd know that this would be completely determined. So in reality, to understand the signal, all you need to know is this column, because once you have this, then you'd know what these columns would be. They don't add anything extra. On the other hand, if you had enough data to estimate pairwise, third order dependencies or second order, I don't know how you come. So if you knew what's the probability of this given both of these, then that would be sufficient information too, because if you had a T and a T here, you're guaranteed to have an A here. And likewise, if you had a C and a T here, you're guaranteed to have a C here. Okay. So the dependencies can be distant, because this depends on this. They don't have to be adjacent. They are asymmetric, and they can be higher order. So you could have, and this is again a very, even though it's a more complicated example than the one we took before, it already shows that things can be quite complicated. And in reality, the dependency structure is quite complicated.
If I saw data like that, my reaction would be, this represents an evolutionary divergence in four different taxa, way ancient, and then all your other examples are just sort of small twigs clustering around these four large branches.
Yes.
And so that the dependencies are not, potentially not there at all, but are just imposed by the phylogenetic structure.
That might well be, but in this case, we have to think, the mechanism of gene translation is so universal that you need to be able to estimate. Let's say that you just had a bunch of human genes. If you just took the sort of gene duplication events as the tree governing this, you would probably not get anything meaningful for such a small signal. So while it's what you're saying is definitely true, and there is some phylogenetics to how this structure could be determined, that's not sufficient information for us to make an algorithm, because often the data is such that you won't be able to get a meaningful tree out of it. But it's a very interesting point, because when Burge and Carlin approached this problem, and this was part of Burge's PhD thesis, they did something very similar to what you're proposing. They didn't, of course, go into the sort of evolution, but just what the tree of these dependencies would look like. What their approach was that you just break these up into submatrices, and then each of these submatrices would capture the kind of dependencies that you were talking about. But the approach for doing that was greedy. So you take the most glaring dependency first, and then you break up the matrices so that you never have things crossing over, dependency in one being confused with the dependency. For example, you would never have a TT followed by a C simply because you'd broken up these two matrices. Okay. And the problem, our approach is actually quite different from this. But so I don't want to go too much into the detail for this, but there are two or three things that are somewhat bothersome. The first is that this is a greedy procedure. You're not sure what you're going to end up with. The procedure, the dependency structure is not that simple that you can just take a greedy algorithm and split it up into submatrices so that each captures a set of dependencies that you're looking at. It can actually be quite complicated. And the second thing is, of course, that as you keep breaking up things, your confidence in these becomes less and less because the data in each is somewhat less, and you don't want that either. Okay, so we approach the problem in a slightly different fashion. And I formally stated, so of course the problem again is one of where you have limited data, you want to be able to estimate some probabilities. So let's say that you had a set of examples and that you were given that you had only enough data to measure kth order correlations. So which of these would be the correct approximation? So you know, you could take a dependence, you could take some subset of dependencies that you could estimate reliably, but based on that, then you would have to give a probability value. And what's the right way to do that? Okay, so that's really the kind of question that we are trying to answer here. Yeah. Actually, you need quite a lot of data. I think that's not very hard to compute. So let's say that you just had a column, right? You typically you have A, C's, G's, and T's. So you can imagine that if you just took counts, how many you would need? I don't know. It's like whatever you're comfortable with. But if you had about 200 or 300 sequence alignments, then you could estimate the probability of A, C, G, and T reliably in a single position. When you take first-order dependencies, you're already, you know, squaring, like you're already getting a square root of what you were, the confidence you had before, and then as you increase the order, it just increases as an exponent of the number of as an exponent in k. So, you know, a third order is already impractical for most realistic biological data, but, you know, yeah, you could go a little further. But at the same time, I don't want to say that there will never be cases where you don't have enough data to estimate higher order dependencies. Maybe this is one application, but there could be other applications where you could estimate, say, third order or fourth order dependencies. You'd still like a general procedure that can deal with all of these in a meaningful fashion. Okay. So, in order to sort of deal with that question, we backtrack a little bit and just think of what the signal means to us. So the most important thing of a signal is that you should be able to distinguish it from the background. Right? It has to be discriminative in some sense, otherwise any stretch of sequence could be the signal. And of course, the classic way of doing that is to consider the information in the signal, which is defined in the, you know, in exactly this straightforward manner. So you have the entropy, and if you assume the uniform background, then it would be 2n minus entropy, because at each position there are four possibilities and there's a maximum of two bits. But we don't have to do it this way. I mean, if we had some kind of an assumption on the background distribution, like some arbitrary probabilities, you could take the Kullback-Leibler distance and that would still give you a measure of the information. And just to give you an idea of why this is sort of biologically meaningful, again, let's assume that the background is that all of the nucleotides are uniformly distributed. Okay, and let's say that our signal also is uniformly distributed, then at each position, and independently distributed, then the probability of any sort of substring of a fixed length is the same. So all of this quickly sums up to all of this quickly sums up to 2n, and then minus 2n, and then you get a zero. So essentially, if you have uniform, the signal comes from a uniform distribution and background is uniform, obviously you're not going to do any kind of discrimination. And the other extreme case is when the signal is a single fixed string. If it's a single fixed string, then there is basically no entropy is zero, and you have the maximum information of 2n. So fairly straightforward again. Okay. Now, the question is, given a set of signals in which you have some correlation between positions, can you estimate the information content? So both of these examples didn't you know, you don't have to worry about dependence between positions. Once you start worrying about that, then you need to approximate the information. Okay, so we just define one more term, and we'll be ready to set up things. Okay. So remember that our signal is a sort of you can think of it as a joint distribution over a over, say, W variables, where W is the length of the signal, right? And there are some dependencies in the signal. So if you just sort of did a little bit of algebraic manipulation, the entropy of this is nothing but the entropy of the first plus the conditional entropy of the second dependent on the first. And of course, if you had S3, S4, and so on, then it would be the conditional entropy of S3 given S1 and S2.
Is this notation here, the small s's are specific realizations?
Yes.
Space,
yes.
And the capital S's
are random variables. So I'm always uncomfortable while talking about entropy to physicists, because if you probably know more about it than I do. But yes, these are random variables. For our signal, each of these, let's say that this was the first column, then this would take values A, C, G, and T. This is the second column, it would take values A, C, and G. And then you could have, in general, many columns, right? And of course, if you just wrote the formula as is, it would be the probability of seeing any particular signal times log. That would be just the definition. And then you do the algebraic, and you get the entropy of the first column out, and the term that's remaining is basically is the definition of conditional entropy.
So the sum is the sum over all sequences with a certain specification in,
yes,
by capital S1.
Yes.
All other columns are substituted.
Yes, in this case, and you could in this case, just think of it as a two-column signal, but then you can generalize it to a k-column signal by saying that the joint entropy is H of S1 plus H of S2 given S1 plus H of S3 given S1 and S2 and so on. Okay, that's what I wanted. I just wanted, the only reason to put up this slide is to define conditional entropy, just to say what conditional entropy is.
Can I ask you one slide again?
Yes.
This summation is S3.
Yes, yes. Yes, in the next slide, what I have done is, so S is a sequence, so you can also think of it as S equals S1, S2, S3. Okay, there are many ways of thinking of a sequence. One is that it's exactly that, except that they are not independently distributed. So it's S1, and then the distribution of S2 is conditional on S1, and so on. Right. But you're absolutely right.
If you're summing over all, if the right-hand side is summing over all sequences?
Yes, I am.
Why is there any dependence on sequence left when you're done? I mean,
here.
Variable, right?
I'm sorry?
The capital S is sort of a dummy. It's just saying.
Yeah, it's a dummy. Yes.
Yes.
I,
but
yes.
It's not a variable. I think that's what it's confusing.
Well, you could think of it as a variable which has as an instance a string. Okay. Let me just write that down. I guess we already understand the stuff, so I don't really need to. Can I write here? Will that be visible? Okay. So let's say that we have S. You can think of it as a random variable. And you can also think of, and let's say that it's drawn from a set. Set, each element of which is a string of length W. So each element, so every string of length W is an instantiation of this variable S, right? Now we write H of S as nothing but minus, so sum over all instantiations of S, I'm sorry. And remember that this small s corresponds to a string of length W, of probability of S times log of probability of S.
So all little s within the set capital S.
Oh, so that equal to, yeah, you're right. There's a little bit of what you should really say is little s inside S.
So just physically, I think entropy in this sense is representing the uncertainty in these.
Yes, yes.
So the conditional entropy then says, what is the residual uncertainty in 2 given?
You know the uncertainty, given that you know the uncertainty in the first variable.
And so it's averaged over the various possibilities of the first variable, so it's sort of the average of
yes.
the residual entropy.
Yes, yes. But basically what the formula says is that you can take the average and you can decompose it as a sum of conditional entropies. And that's going to be crucial for the algorithm that we design. But yeah, absolutely, you're right. Okay, so I'll proceed. Okay, so we've defined this. Yeah. Here now what I've done is I've expanded S to also think of S as a sort of, you know, this, you can think of this as a random variable, or you can think of this as a random variable. And again, they are taking the same instance as before, except that let's say it's only two columns. And then each instance of this is a substring of length 2. So that's how, so you can, this and this are used equivalently, capital S, and then these are the little s's. That's how the two pictures are matching.
So you're not breaking the original string into
two sub. Oh no, I'm not. I'm think of this as a string of window 2, and I could have written it over a larger window, but yeah, string of length 2. So I'm not.
And capital S1 and capital S2 refer to the same position upstream of the
yes.
start.
Yes. Yeah, the same two positions, right. Okay. Do you want me to? I can also sort of go over the explanation of this, or is this clear to everybody? Is this? Okay, so another picture. You know what happened? They changed the background of our official presentation, but this this sphere and this sphere should have, and I couldn't get the color out here. I mean, I tried all sorts of tricks today morning, but couldn't get the colors to match. But you're not supposed to be seeing these circles, okay? Just to get what the visual picture is, looks like. So,
which circles are we not supposed to see?
Okay, all of this, this, and the two at the top, which look somewhat like this, but not quite.
Another purple one.
Oh, right, you're not supposed to see that one either. That's why the plus makes sense, otherwise the plus would be right inside the circle. So again, you know, it's again the pictorial view of things. You have the total entropy of the system, and you can write it, you can decompose it as the entropy in the first column, plus the conditional entropy in the second condition on the first column, and then the conditional entropy in the, of the third conditions on the first two. But you only have enough data to estimate first order dependencies. So the last term here, you cannot estimate. So when you approximate, you either take the dependence on the first column or you take the dependence on the second column. And to generalize it even more, now, you know, note that this, the equation at the top is insensitive to which column you start with first. But once you approximate, then it becomes very sensitive to what column you start with later, right? So you could have started with the third column and then taken the dependencies on the first, and you would get different answers, right? So because it's not symmetric in any sense. So the question now is that given that you can only estimate some kth order dependencies, how do you find the structure that minimizes the total entropy, the approximation of the total entropy of the system, and therefore maximizes the predictive power? So every time you make an information, you're losing some predictive power. And what you want to do is to pick the approximation that maximizes the predictive power. And then that's the architecture that we'll use to estimate what our signal. And we'll take this, we'll go through this with an example, so it'll become clear for the specific example. But just to state this formally again, so let you know, consider a set of predecessor functions which have the following property, that they don't form a cycle. So you can't have you can't choose a predecessor function in which the predecessor of column 1 is 2, and then the column predecessor, and there's a cycle, you know, 2 is dependent on 3 and so on, and then 3 something comes back to be dependent on 1. So for any set of predecessor functions in which you have a partial order, you can actually say that if you take the sum of the conditional entropies, as I've stated here, you will always overestimate the disorder. And that I'll show you why that is. It's not very difficult to see. And therefore, you'll always underestimate the total information. But if you take the one with the minimum disorder, then in a sense, with the amount of data, you know, since you can only compute first-order dependencies, that's the best you can do. And that's the problem that we have to solve computationally. So given enough samples to compute first-order dependencies, find this predecessor function so that there is no cycle and so on, but which it's the one that maximizes the information, the amount of information that you can possibly gain from the system. So just to give you a quick note on the fact that this problem is solvable in polynomial time, and then we'll go back and see why this is interesting to us. So here's the auxiliary structure that we make that allows us to solve this problem. Okay, for every column, consider a node in a graph. Okay, and then finally consider a dummy node, which is S0. From S0 to all of the other columns, just give a weight of 2 minus HS1. So selecting that edge really corresponds to saying that S1 is not dependent on anything else. Okay, and that so therefore the total disorder in, due to S1 is exactly H of S1, and the total information is 2 minus H of S1. Again, assuming that the background is uniform. From S1 to S2, you have an edge which says 2 minus the conditional entropy of S2 given S1. So this, if you take this edge, that means you've already chosen S1, and then you're getting the extra amount of information that you get when you choose S2 is exactly this. Okay. And the theorem is that the signal, the solution to the first order problem, that is to find a predecessor function, that means for every node you want to pick an in edge, so that there is no cycle in the graph, okay? But the sum of all the information, sum of the sort of information at each edge, that's part of the proof, but basically the total information that is contained in that particular system is maximized. And that is nothing but, you know, in this graph, you want a subgraph in which every vertex has at most one incoming edge, and then the sum of the edge weights is the maximum, which is a branching. And while it's not trivial to solve, it's fairly standard in computer science, and there are solutions involving primal dual.
What do you call the single problem?
Say that again?
In the book you said the one single problem.
Yeah.
That means about two signal problems.
Yeah, it has to be generalized to a k-signal problem. So I'll only give you a hint about that because we never really published on sort of higher order dependencies. One signal problem means that you're only capturing first order dependencies. Two signal means you're capturing second order dependencies and so on. I'll just hold on a minute. I'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, just about definitions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about the definition of what the K signal problem would be. Okay. Again, if I can write here. So what do you want to do? You have all of these. You have all of these variables, say S1, S2, S3, S4. You only have enough data that you can estimate first. Let's just talk about the one signal problem again, then we'll come back to the two signal. You only have enough data that you can estimate first order dependencies. So the only thing you can measure is for S2 that it is dependent on S1. Now it could be dependent on S3, S4 as well, but you have to pick one because that's all you can estimate. Okay, so the one signal problem is that you find a permutation of these nodes, and for every node you put at most one predecessor so that the predecessor comes from a node before it. This ensures that there is no cycle. Okay, so there is one, and then there could be another, and then this node is independent. So for every node you pick at most one predecessor. In this case you don't pick any predecessor for these two. But you do pick for this, S2 is the predecessor. And once you've picked the predecessor, then you get get the information in the system can be obtained by summing up all the edge weights if you label them correctly. And so that would be this one signal problem. Now, if you had two signal problem, that means you have enough data to estimate second order and higher order, second order dependencies. That means for every node, you can pick two dependent nodes. Again, the goal is to find a permutation so that for every node, there are at most two other incoming edges, and both must come from its left so that there's no cycle. That's another way of looking at it. Yeah. So that would be the K-signal problem. Okay. Now, why is this meaningful? Okay, so let's take this example that we took before. Again, to get in, to sort of reorient you, this column completely determines the other two columns, right? Because if you know that there's an A here, there will be a T here. If you know that there's a C here, then there's a T here and there's a C here. And it, as you go down, you'll see that that's the case. I just added another row to break some symmetry. Okay. Now, if you look at the increase in entropy, so from S0 to S3, that means you're taking S3 as independent. You can think that S3 is pretty much the uniform distribution, except that T is a little overrepresented. Okay. So the entropy in this will be very close to 2. And because we, you know, if you go back to the previous page, what you're taking is 2 minus of HS1 as the weight on there. So the information in this, if you just took this column, there's very little information in this. But once you've chosen this column, note that the other two columns are completely determined, right? So what that means is that the information increase from here to here is 2 because the relative entropy is, the conditional entropy is 0. And likewise, the information increase from here to here is 2, conditional entropy. If you took other edges, just to give you a sense of what it might be like, this would be very close to 1. This would be very close to 1 again, because from going from S1 to S3, there is some information gain. If you knew that there was a T here, you know that there has to be either an A here or a G here, A and G. So, right? So you have like each of them occurring with a probability half. That means that the conditional entropy is about 1. Okay, this symmetry breaks makes it a little more than 1, so it's a little less than 1, and then this is a 2. So if you had to take this as your branching, that would have something a little less than 4, while this is a little greater than 4. Okay? S sub 0 is a dummy node that we choose, and we choose an edge from S sub 0 if you don't want any predecessor for this. Okay, and the reason for that is to add the extra information. Let me go back here. Okay, you need to add this to get this. So whenever you're not choosing anything dependent on another, you have to add the amount of information in that column that's given to this. So it's just a construct to allow facilitate that. Now in this example, what we are saying is that once you have this, then you have the architecture with which you can estimate the probabilities. So once you're given an unknown string S1, remember our question was which approximation is the correct one. Now we know that what you do is you follow this. S3 is not dependent on anything. S1 is dependent on S3, and S2 is dependent on S3. That's the correct one. And the reason it's the correct one is because for all of the signals, this gives you the most amount of information. So as long as you estimate things like this, you're on the average, you're going to do well. Okay. No, actually, the reason for putting epsilon is the following. So if you imagine you didn't have this, okay, then this would be completely uniform. So there would be absolutely no information in just choosing this. I put an extra thing here to get a little positive, just to break some symmetry. Otherwise, you get other paths which are similar. But that's just a symmetry breaking thing. Okay, and then I already talked about the K-signal problem. So if you, this was only when you could, when you had enough data to estimate first order dependencies. As you have more data to estimate higher order dependencies, what you need is a more general function, and then you need to be able to find this. Now, this doesn't look like a branching structure at first glance, because in a branching, you crucially depend on the fact that you have only one incoming edge. But a little extra construction can actually help you convert this into a branching problem. And there you take every node not as a single column, but as pairs of columns. So you take the appropriate K-square number of codes, and then you're if you take the dependencies appropriately, you get first order. I can go a little bit into detail, but that's not, we've never published on that, so it's something of interest. But, if you're interested, we can talk about this at the end of the talk. Okay, so that's the key.
What's the strategy to find optimal?
So the strategy is just that you build this auxiliary graph, and then you compute the branching in this graph. And there's a standard algorithm for doing that. So the branching is exactly the problem where you're given a directed graph with weights on the edges. and you're supposed to find a subgraph, okay, in which has the following property. It's acyclic. Every vertex is at most one incoming edge. And that's all. I mean, these are the two properties. And the sum of the weights is the maximum. It's almost like spanning tree, but it's not quite as easy to do. But it's doable, yes?
So what happens when you don't have an example like what you had, one site really does give you a whole lot more information?
Even so, the branching that you get is the most you have to take a branching as your answer, because you can only take first order dependencies. So that much is guaranteed. Why not take the branching that will give you the most informative signal? Yeah, that's possible, and that would be useful to know too, and then you would have to choose one or the other. But you're right. Oh yes, it does, because at least the number of branchings from which you choose reduces. So instead of having, you know, the number of possible branchings of this graph is quite huge. If you could get a small subset of these which all had the maximum score, it would still be better to choose from that. Yeah. Oh, then you don't get anything. No, that's not the case. If the data is indeed independently distributed, so there is no dependency in the position.
But I do not have many data.
Right. Yeah. Let's just say that that's a different question, because if you don't have enough data, then your answer don't make sense. But let's say you have enough data, but there is no dependencies.
Yeah, of course.
That's the interesting case, right? Then your branching would be this edge, this edge, and this edge. Everything would have an incoming S0, and that would be exactly the profile solution. Right? The profile solution is where everything is independent, and in this includes as one of the solutions the profile solution, because if you take everything as point coming from S0, that means every position is generated independently.
Presumably, I think you need data, of course, and there's no problem. But I think the advantage here is that if you don't have enough data, you can still pinpoint which one's more dominant.
No, but
I'm saying that if I have some profile generating this random sequences, and somehow I don't have enough data, I still use this methodology. I mean, each branch would not still carry the same.
But that's not how the way you would do it is the following. So you take your data, and then you first compute the given the amount of data, what's the kind of dependency you can estimate without problem. So if you have confidence that you can estimate first order dependencies, then you apply the one signal problem. If you have confidence that you can only estimate zeroth order, you can't estimate, then you apply the zero signal problem, which is just the profile. So that's how you would do it. Yeah, I will talk a little bit about that.
If you have a way to divide the links you found afterwards based on the finite size of data, right? It's a significant link. Because once you specify the first order problem, you always find an optimal solution.
Yes. No. So that's not how we do that. We don't, when we say we are going to solve the one signal problem, we don't assume that there's only first order dependence. We're saying that we only have enough data to estimate first order dependencies. So let's say that you had enough data to estimate second order dependency and you solved a two signal problem. That would still include as a subset all the one signal and all the zero signal. So if there was no dependence, that would fall out.
This is not my question. Because you can have a finite data that has low independence in principle, but when you try to use this first order data to estimate, you saw some link between, say, one, two.
No, but
size.
Hold on. What's the input to your first order? The input are these edges, right? Which talk about you only put in these edges if you have confidence in them. The reliability of the data is a sort of different question. We deal with it upfront. So first we take the data set and we see what do we have confidence in. If we are seeing a dependency between two positions, we see what is the confidence we have for those. And we only take those dependencies if we feel that the data is sufficient that we can have confidence. Yes, and it is susceptible to all the problems that come with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Just a difference in language. So you speak computer science language, I don't speak
computer. Right.
When you say there is branching on a graph and you call it algorithm graph, can you just clarify what is the problem?
Yes, the computer science problem is the following. You're given a directed graph with weights. The reason for calling it auxiliary is just because it's derived from the set of alignments. Otherwise, it's just auxiliary just means it's a graph which is derived from the. Okay. So the branching problem, as we solve it, is a directed graph with weights on edges, positive weights on edges, I'm sorry. Okay, and you want to find as answer a subgraph, okay, in which all the nodes have degree at most, in degree at most one, and there is no cycle. And that is a branching. And an optimum branching is such a subgraph with maximum weight. On. Okay, I'm sorry, yeah. Well, let me write it again. Input. And I call it A for arcs, which means they are directed edges with so this means that there is a weight function on edges. Every time you have an arc, you can take a positive weight on it. Okay? And goal, find so find a subset of arcs of the edges such that for all arcs, well, let me write it in English because I can write it formally, but it might lose the intuition. Every node has at most one incoming edge. There is no cycle. And then so this is a branching. If any subset of arc satisfies this, it's called a branching. A maximum weight branching. So we have to find a maximum weight branching. Maximum weight branching is a branching A prime branching, or let's call it B, such that WB, which is the sum of the weights of its arcs, is greater than WB prime for all branchings B prime. At most one incoming edge is unlimited.
And
every site doesn't have to be visited, but the fact that all of these are positive will guarantee that. Okay. So here, let's take some examples. This is a branching. This is a branching. Note that this still satisfies the one in degree, but it doesn't satisfy the cycle criterion. So that's not a branching. And you can't have this because it has two in degree nodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So once you have a branching, then you can find an ordering, a reorder, you can reorder the nodes so that the arcs only go from left to right. And the only reason for bringing that order up, it would not have been necessary if we were just doing this, but for the K-signal problem, you can't just formulate it in terms of a branchings. I mean, you can, but it's a more involved construction. You need to be able to talk in terms of permuting the nodes so that every edge goes only from left to right. Oh, no. You can change the order of the position. The question is, what is the order of positions that you need to consider? It's not. So you're given one order, but you can change it, and you have to find the right order so that once you take a branching on that order, you get the most informative signal. Like in the example that we took, maybe I can have this again. Just turn it on. Oops. it's coming up. Okay, so in this example that I took, note that the order of the nucleotides was S1 followed by S2 followed by S3, but the order in which we compute is that we first take S3 and then S1 depending on S3 and S2. So we are allowed to change the order. Yes?
I'm confused why you're trying to find the maximum extraction rate and the minimum extraction. Because you're trying to estimate the information in the true, and it seems like whenever you break it down and you ignore information, so you're using this first order, you're overestimating the information. So
we are always underestimating the information. I didn't say that explicitly, but this is what happens. So this is the other thing so anytime you take kth order dependency, you're overestimating the figure that I drew, the one that talked about the overestimation, that was for the entropy. So you're overestimating the entropy, but you're underestimating the information. And indeed, you can actually say, a very nice thing is that you can always say, not only do you say that you are underestimating the information, you're always doing better with higher order dependencies. So as you increase your dependencies, you get closer and closer to the most informative, which is the most natural way of looking at it. So if you had first order dependency, you'd maximize the information, but you'd still be less than the information. When you take second order, you'd maximize, you'd always be better than the first order, but you'd still be, that's the kind. And if you want to see the intuition for why this is I need to go back, I'm sorry. Oh, that's clear. Why?
I see that. I see
that. I'm used to likelihood formalism rather than the information formalism. And in that, if I wanted, so imagine I have enough data and I have to do first order correlations. And I say, okay, given the optimal first order correlations, I have this. But then I want to look at a branch and I want to say, is this correlation here significant or not?
Yes.
I could always increase this, the information content, by having that branch.
Yes.
I'm thinking with likelihood, you could do likelihood ratio tests and things like that. Is there any way of evaluating, because it will always have some information content there through the finite sample.
Yes.
Is there any way of judging whether it's a finite sample effect or whether it's a real correlation there?
So the likelihood, the sort of philosophy is very different in the sense that if you were to do likelihood, right, then for every signal, you could try all possible architectures and all possible edges, and you would say and then you would apply the statistical test that you just mentioned to say, is this dependence likely? I mean, is this just by chance, or is this dependence supported by other things? It's a very different kind of question we are asking. What we are asking is that from this set of data, what's the best, given that all of these dependencies are correct? So what has happened is that somebody has already done these tests and said that all of these edges are reliable. That is, you can get, there might be some edge effects, but these, we can say with confidence that there's this amount of dependence. But in spite of that, you can only choose a subset of these to compute your score for, because otherwise what you get is not a meaningful value. So given that you have a set of things which you've passed all your statistical tests, and you know that the likelihoods for this are solid and all, which is the best subset you want to choose to find your signal?
Yeah, but there's still, I could imagine that there would be some branches here where there are no correlations, and that,
yes.
That they would be induced by the model and by the
yes.
finite sample.
So you would do your test and you would not consider those to be edges in your nodes. You would remove them as edges, or you'd give them basically zero information.
Let me think of the same question a different way. Branch, you're never 100% reliable.
Yes.
Okay. So there's a little bit of fuzziness in every.
Yes. Link. So we are not answering that. You're right. I mean, the philosophy itself is different. We are sort of threshold. Let's say that you had some threshold.
Let me compose a different computational problem.
Yes.
Each link has a probability so many percent of having that weight.
Yes.
Now I want to find the one with the maximum link. Is there some algorithm that will extend what you described to find the maximum weight? Is there an algorithm to extend to this?
Yes. Yeah, well, there is. So I understand the question that if indeed it's a different question, which is that if the weights really represented probabilities,
yes.
Then you find the most likely branching.
Yes. Right.
Yes,
but
you can. The branching would still give you the optimum, the same solution of the same problem would still give you the most likely branch if you take probabilities.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that because it's not natural for us to do it that way.
Is there an algorithm that would define the...
Well, like I said, it's the same algorithm would work. Only thing you have to do is to replace the weight of an edge by the probability of that edge. Then the branching would be the most likely...
Yeah, but instead of finding the maximum probability file...
Oh,
if
you wanted to generate things with the... Yes. Oh, yeah, you can. I mean, that actually is not... for the case of branching, for probabilities, if you take undirected edges, okay, so if you don't worry about direction, I think that can be done. For direction, I'm not sure, it's not trivial to do that. But for undirected case, that could be done.
I think it's actually an important question, too.
Yeah, it's a very important question.
Yeah. The notation that we use is inspired by the market chain theory.
Yes.
And the market chain theory, we have a principle that if you are in a certain point in
yes.
your trajectory, it doesn't matter what's happening before.
Yes.
You can predict the future or compute the future starting from that point. And it's not obvious for me that when you do branching process,
yes.
you still are under this market assumption.
Okay. I think I do understand your question. First, the branching that we are talking about is totally different from the branching process. So, but with respect to your first question, that is about a Markov chain, this is not so much about how to sort of, where you're given a Markov chain and you want to estimate probabilities of being in a state. It's not a question of that type. It's a question of type, what is the architecture of your Markov chain? That's the question that we're trying to answer, which is a very different kind of question, I think. So if your question was to estimate what's the best architecture for the Markov chain, given that all of these architectures were feasible and you had some optimality criterion, that's the kind of question that this is trying to answer.
So you think you can overview the Markov chain or a certain architecture if you get a solution to the branch problem?
Yes, that's sort of what I'm saying. But the solution might not be meaningful in a general scenario, but in this scenario, it is a meaningful solution because it gives it tells you something about the signal.
Can this algorithm find, say, the five best architectures and how this might be?
Yeah, I think that's sort of related to his question. Yes, it can if they are. Yes, it can. I'm not 100% sure. Okay, so like I said, if it was undirected. Yes, there are standard ways of taking the maximum spanning tree and then the second best node for branchings. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's possible.
Do you know the statistics of your optimal? So you get some optimal weight for the optimal
yes.
time. And if you're throwing random bounds, you're going to still get some number. Do you know the distribution?
No, it's. I think it's very hard to make a general statement like that because if there was a lot of signal, so let's say that your signal was really, it was indeed this signal, right? If you threw something randomly at it, it would give you the right answer, whereas the other methods would not. So yes, but if the dependency structure was weak to begin with, there, you know, so it really depends on what the data looks like.
But the question you're asking is, for instance, how many exits do I have? What happens?
Another way to ask, I just want to find the properties of this kind of the solution. If I change one number slightly, how sensitive is it to, like if I change
the branching number,
would I cause a complete rearrangement?
Yes, it depends very much on the input weight, so it really depends on the data you're given.
So
that's why
you could have to be in
yes.
one region, could be another region.
Yes, so there could be, you could be given data where the dependencies are weak, in which there would be many different solutions and all would be off by only some amount.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be no one good architecture. I think that's the first question
that
you asked, so it's related to that.
Eventually, you want to use this architecture to make predictions, right? So as long as your prediction is insensitive to the... So in the case, if the whole branching structure is sensitive to some noise,
yes.
but the final prediction...
Would also be sensitive. Well, might not be. Yeah, it could be insensitive, you're right, because if a lot of architectures look really alike, then it doesn't matter which you choose in your final probability estimate. That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, that's I think is a very good point.
can you handle hidden nodes? Like, for instance, I can imagine that there are actually four nodes there, and one and two depend upon the status of four, which depends on the status of three. Can you deal with architectures like that with hidden data?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know in general if I can or not. I think there are some sort of ways that spring to mind, but it's not something I've thought about.
I think I'm curious what you can ask.
No, I appreciate the question. I think I am, and it's a good question, but I don't have, I think, good ideas on that question.
We also would like to give you an opportunity.
No, actually, I'm almost...
We should have a 10-minute break and then come back.
No, I'm done, actually, so... I just want to say that this is work done with a colleague, Pankaj Agarwal at Smith Lang. Just wanted to mention his name.
Just to have an answer to the question that to what extent we have the competence to assign one level, two level, three level, correct? How many data do you need for you to achieve that?
I think it's whatever you know you're happy with, like some biologists are happy doing second order with three data points, but in our approach, we use some correlation coefficient. We use some standard techniques in a very conservative fashion to say this is.
But that's also quite arbitrary.
It is arbitrary. There is no good answer to that question. I mean, you have to let's build upon your experience with.
Basically, beyond some point, make more brain, more structural, more predictive powers.
Yes, I agree.
On the same kind of question.
Do you have a new example where you use this higher order?
No, actually, I wanted to say a word about that. So when Chris Burge and Carlin did their work, they mentioned that it was very it improved their gene prediction quite significantly. So it's possible, but when we tried this on both translation initiation and splice, we did not really find distant correlations that were significant. I mean, there was some improvement, it was like 2.2 bits or something, which was not enough to really improve your predictive power. So, no, actually. At least in the biological cases that we studied, we did not really find anything. But it could be that the modest improvements that you get in conjunction with other techniques or gene finding improve the gene finding quality. That's certainly possible.
Yeah? There was a picture.
Oh, the picture at the end? that's my colleagues. These are not the people I did this work with, but just to give you an idea of what kind of things we work on. Everybody gets Nerf weapons. And this is Gene Myers at the left end. He's the head. Then most of the people here, this is a very early photograph. I'm not in it myself. This is the core team that implemented the assembly algorithm. Okay, thank you.